let's talk about the sacrum. The sacrum has become a, shall we say, a bone of contention, pun intended. The sacrum, as some people argue, is five independent segments, and you need to adjust the individual segments in order to properly address the sacrum. Others would say that you don't need to do that. You simply need to adjust the bone as one unit, as a whole, PL, PR, base posterior, that's it. I do not intend to settle this argument, but what I might end up doing is throwing some gasoline on the fire, because I kind of want to give you a third option between those two. And to do that, I'm going to reference William Ruck's book, which is The Atlas of Common Subluxations of the Human Spine and Pelvis. In this book, towards the back of it, he talks about the sacrum as he gets into the pelvic girdle. And so let me read to you a few things that he's written here. He writes, the sacrum is usually depicted as a solid bone, but I found that even specimens 90 to 100 years old have viable discs in the sacrum between S1 and S2 and S2 and S3. The presence of a disc implies sacral motion, because from a physiological point of view, a fibrocartilaginous disc requires motion for survival. These sacral discs are tied to and biomechanically related to the sacroiliac joints and ligaments. The sacrum and the sacroiliac joints are angled from top to bottom and from front to back. The appearance of these structures on the variety of types of imaging and positions can be quite different. To make the evaluation process even more complex, the sacrum can be either parallel or nearly perpendicular to the ground or anywhere in between. So that just gets us started off. If you're not familiar with William Ruck's book, he took over 200 cadavers and he x-rayed them prior to dissecting them. And so in his book, you get to see side by side what the specimen looks like, and you can see the subluxations, you can see the disc, you can see what's happening. And then right next to it, you can see that same appearance on x-ray to draw the distinction between what it looks like when we see it on x-ray versus what's happening in the real body, and to get that idea of how things are working. And so in the process of doing that, he found what he would determine to be normal based on finding it frequently, and what might be less normal, finding it less frequently. And so, as you may have gotten from that, he found discs between S1 and S2 and between S2 and S3, but he did not generally find them lower. And so his conclusion is that S1 and S2 are movable, S3, S4, and S5, normally, under normal circumstances, are not. Now, there are times when you can have a lower sacrum that does move. That would be considered abnormal, and it's usually the result of trauma that never allowed the final, I guess, fusion process to take place in the lower sacrum. On the flip side, you can have upper sacral segments that don't move because of a trauma that caused them to degenerate, just like a spine would, and now you don't have the proper movement. Let me read to you now another thing that he wrote that I think is very interesting when it comes to this part of the sacrum. He has, the sacral discs are evident to the 9th and 10th decades of life. In the limited study presented here, there's evidence of intrasacral subluxation. The S1, S2 disc has a dorsal and ventral cortical bone covering. This will thicken with loss of integrity between the S1 and S2 segments, and the disc will dehydrate. The S2 and S3 segments seem to have the same relationship. So what he's talking about is a cortical bone covering around the disc. This means that an S1 and an S2 are going to move very different from an L4 and an L5, which if you've adjusted them, you know that's true. But that thin cortical bone covering means that you don't want to damage that or rupture that in the process of trying to correct a sacral subluxation. So that means that precision of line of drive and precision of depth are going to be super important, because you need to make a change in the disc without disrupting the cortical bone on the edges. And that's a whole other level of precision when it comes to making a good adjustment on those segments. So I think that's something definitely to think about. And to me, that's what throws gasoline on the fire, because as is common, we say all or nothing, black and white. Either you adjust all the segments or you adjust none of the segments. And the reality is we might need to look at doing both. We've got the S1, we've got the S2, they're movable. They function with the SI joint. We've got S3, S4, S5. They do not function typically with part of the SI joint. Possibly the upper part of S3 may form the inferior portion of the SI on some people. One of the things William Ruck found with the SI joint is that there was greater variability in that joint than there was with any other joint. If you're not aware, the posterior portion of the SI joint is fibrous, and the anterior portion of the SI joint is synovial. So it's two joints combined in one. And yet, if you ask, well, how much is synovial compared to fibrous? William Ruck's answer was he could find no consistent pattern. It varied that much. He said, I can't even tell you a ratio of how much one is to the other because there's that much variation. It just depends from person to person. So when you're looking at a SI joint, you're looking at the greatest variability, he said, in the body, which he also went on to say that that's highly unusual for a joint. Typically, the way they work is the way they work, and so they tend to look the same from person to person to person. The SI joint being such a major exception when you consider the role it plays in weight bearing and locomotion. But we'll get to that more here in just a second. So let's get back towards the sacrum and understand the sacral side of things. Last year, when we were in Kansas City, at Cleveland College of Chiropractic in Kansas City, Overland Park to be specific, I was fortunate enough to join with the fellows where they did a special dissection. And I've mentioned this before on previous things, but one of the big takeaways that I got from that dissection was him talking to us about the fact that the SI joint is a tongue and groove, a true tongue and groove. And I had often told patients that, thinking that it's not really true, but it's close enough, they'll get the picture, helps them to understand. And that's what it always felt like when I adjusted it. But when I understood that it truly was a tongue and groove, then you have to understand that as you're adjusting the ilium to the sacrum, for example, you have not completed the adjustment until the tongue clips back into the groove. And so after that experience with the dissection, one of the things I would do is if I pull an ilium, say I pull an EX ilium, sometimes I feel that it gets close, but it doesn't really clip in the way it needs to clip in. I will then flip the patient over, or sometimes I'll do it prone. I won't even do it side posture, but I have to get, I know that the tongue part on the ilium is close to the groove on the sacrum. I've got to get it to clip in. And so I either adjust it prone with a slight I to S and then mostly a lateral to medial to get to clip in, or I will do it as a push move, but I'm not trying to set it way anterior or anything like that. I'm trying to set it into the sacrum and get that clip. And I have found since that dissection and since it changed the way I think, and once I started doing the adjustments in that way, it's made a huge difference on being able to get sacrums to almost, I mean iliums, to almost immediately work, basically SI joints, to work right, whether it's sacrum or ilium. But then you have the issue of if you're trying to set an ilium to a sacrum, but that sacrum's rotated, that's not gonna work either. So there are situations where you gotta straighten out the sacrum first. So it starts with a sacral listing, PR, PL. Once you get that sacrum balanced, then you may not even have a true ilium subluxation, but you still have to clip that ilium back into the sacrum because it's sitting right next to it. It's just not in the groove where it can function. And so this kind of understanding of the sacroiliac joint and its incredible complexity, and yet when you think about a true tongue and groove, when that tongue is in the groove, you have both perfect mobility and perfect stability. And when it comes out, you lose both the mobility and the stability. The brain recognizes that immediately, and it's going to shift some portion of your weight onto the other side, and it's not going to want to carry it over there. And so clipping that back in brings that back into balance, and really that's what most compensation is simply just keeping our head above our feet, keeping us balanced, and keeping us walking with locomotion the way that we're supposed to. And so the SI joint plays a huge role in disrupting that when it goes south. And so the reason I bring that up is because when we get to the sacrum, for some people, that sacroiliac groove on the sacral side, it may extend down to the upper portion of S3. And so for that individual, they could have an S3 subluxation and they need to have it fixed, otherwise it won't work. So we can't say absolutely anything, but we can get an idea of what is normal. And according to William Ruck, what is normal is that S1 and S2 should be mobile joints. And so being mobile joints means that they have the potential for subluxation. And if they are subluxated, they will become immobile joints. And that's going to disrupt the biomechanics of the entire pelvis. So in order to reestablish those mechanics, we need to be able to set an S1 and an S2. I actually am of the belief that S1 is harder to set correctly than S2. And the reason for that, I believe, has to do with the natural kyphosis of the sacrum, which brings me to another point William Ruck points out. He shows x-rays where the sacrum has lost its kyphosis and it's totally flat. And you've probably seen this on x-ray, where you see a patient with a flat sacrum and they've lost that. And he talks about how that is a compensation, but it's a compensation that as you lose that kyphosis, it means S2 has moved anterior. You've got some really abnormal weight bearing. And so a lot of times, I believe that flattening has to do with like an L5 subluxation, could potentially be an SI with the ilium, but most likely it's an L5 or L4 subluxation that's then causing the sacrum to bear weight funny. So in order to reinforce itself, it pulls out the kyphosis and it goes flat like that. So the fact that you can even see a sacrum, and he has evidence in the book of one that's flat, he uses that as an example of this is how and this is why S1 and S2 are movable. Because in that situation, S3, S4, S5, they actually haven't moved at all. They're staying exactly where they're supposed to be. It's only S1, S2 that come forward. But in the normal kyphosis of the sacrum, S2 is the apex. And typically, if you just lift it I to S a little bit, then you can, it's really easy to set it P to A. But the S1 on most people has more of an S to I trajectory, which means that in side posture, you can't have your elbow in an inferior position. It can't be down below, like behind your shoulder. You have to lift your elbow ends up going way out in front of you, so you're almost pushing back at yourself because you've got to drop that S1 over the top. And they come in, as he mentioned, they come in all angles, everything from perpendicular to the floor to parallel to the floor. And so with the sacrum, it really has to be a custom-made adjustment for that patient, because they're going to have a very specific angle. And this is why having a standing x-ray of the sacrum is going to give you the best information on knowing what that angle should be and how to set it on top. And there's definitely a lot of clues you can pick up from palpation as well, but especially for somebody who's more novice or just beginning, your best bet's going to be to see it on film and have an idea of how that, what angle it's sitting at and where the plane line is, and to know how are you going to set it back down on there in order to get it set in correctly. To further understand the functioning of the pelvis and the role the sacrum plays, let's take a minute to talk about the hip joint. William Ruck writes in here that the femur is an enormous lever. A handle on a wrench as long as the leg would snap a 3/4-inch tightened bolt in a partial turn. The joints and ligaments that hold the pelvic girdle together must withstand tremendous rotational and shearing forces. Part of the strength and stability of the pelvis is its flexibility. I think that's key, because what's hidden in there is that when you think about people having hip joints that wear down and they have to have hip replacements, what is the underlying cause of that? Well, there's a lot of things we could say. I know that we often say, oh, it's the ASI and ilium, that's what leads to that. But ultimately what he's talking about is that that becomes a risk anytime you lose the flexibility of the pelvis. And it has to do with the tremendous shearing forces and rotational forces that the hip can create. That's, I believe, one of the reasons why there's a ligament in there to limit some of those forces. The ligament that holds the head of the femur into the acetabulum is going to keep that ball from just shifting around. Imagine if that ligament wasn't there and all the movement that ball could make. Like he said, the leg is a long lever. That long lever is creating so much force at that point, it would tear that joint up. So there's a number of things that hold it together. And so through that ligament, you're then going to take those forces and translate them into the pelvis. From that point, the pelvis is going to stabilize and deal with those forces using a combination of the SI joint and the pubic symphysis. And so you can think of it as a three-joint complex between the hip, the SI, pubic symphysis. And so William Ruck actually dissected out a number of pubic symphysis, or symphysi, maybe that's the plural, I have no idea. But one of the things he said about it is that when he dissected it out, he found it to be not much different than any other disc in the body, even to the point of having something that looks like a rudimentary nucleus pulposus. So he talks about how important it is to keep that joint functioning as well, because they translate the forces back and forth. And so when you have a patient who has a subluxated SI joint, you should automatically assume that their hip is taking undue abuse, because mechanically that has to be the case. And most likely it's probably the pubic symphysis that's hypermobile as the compensation for that subluxation. And so if you can imagine your head, the hip is moving, the SI joint is not moving, so it's now stationary, and the pubic symphysis is moving all over the place in order to stabilize that hip. Obviously, that's not normal biomechanics, and just as obviously for us, we understand we need to free up that ilium, we need to move the SI joint and get it functioning again, and by doing that, we take those additional forces off the pubic symphysis, and we give it a chance to function as it should. There's a few other things here I want to read to you from William Ruck. In fact, let me just give you his basic introduction to the pelvis. In the adult, the pelvic girdle is a three-bone complex, including the sacrum and the right and left innominates. Innominate is a Latin word meaning no name, referring to its embryonic origin as three separate bones, the ilium, ischium, and pubis. Three joints unite the bones of the pelvic girdle, the two sacroiliac joints and the pubic symphysis. The sacrum is the base of the spine and the pelvic girdle. As a whole, is the anchor for quite a substantial part of the musculature system of the spine, legs, thorax, and abdomen. All of the abdominal, hip, and thigh muscles originate from the pelvic girdle, as do the two large back muscles, the erector spinae and the latissimus dorsi. So it's not difficult to see how subluxations of the pelvic girdle can affect any or all of these muscle groups, causing them to contract, become hypertonic, or go into spasm. The key to understanding the etiology of much low back pain is the integrity and function of the three pelvic joints. What I love about what he wrote is making it very clear that these muscles tighten up, spasm, protect when the joints of the pelvis do not work correctly. Pelvic subluxation is not caused by, quote, short or tight muscles. That's not the case. It's never been the case. Muscles don't get short, they get contracted. And if they get contracted, they do it for a reason. It's to protect, it's to defend, it's to limit mobility so things don't get worse. The musculature system is always secondary to the primary subluxation, which, I guess to be blunt and bold, is the reason why chiropractic works much more effectively than physical therapy. Because physical therapy is based on a bad idea of short muscles, tight muscles. And when chiropractors fall into that trap and start telling their patients that the reason you have a subluxation is because you've got a tight muscle, you're headed down a road and digging yourself a hole you can never get out of, because that's not the case. We find it all over the place. And so I love that part of this book, because it demonstrates that those things are required to happen when there's subluxation of the pelvis and of the low back. He also has a very interesting section, because if we're going to follow this through to completion, we have to think about how the pelvic subluxation affects the organs that are contained within the pelvis. So let me read to you what he writes about that. A variety of complaints can result from subluxations of the pelvic joints, including urogenital and intestinal problems. In a normal female pelvis, the broad ligament stretches between the two ilii, suspending the ovaries and the uterus. When the pelvic girdle subluxates, the broad ligament skews as the ilia displace with respect to one another. This changes the position of the ovaries and the uterus in the abdominal cavity and can exacerbate any problem that might exist. The pelvic examination can reveal tight and tender musculature on one side and the uterus traction to one side. I think that a large percentage of gynecological pathology may be the result of unresolved pelvic trauma. Correction of the subluxation complexes of the pelvic girdle has been shown to clinically relieve or reverse these conditions. I've also encountered instances of testicular pain ensuing from subluxation of the pubic symphysis. This can be explained anatomically by the fact that the testicular nerve, artery, and vein traverse the top of the pubic rami before they descend into the testicles, creating a neurovascular bundle that can become entrapped in some individuals. So again, we're getting back to just simple anatomy. When two things are located close to each other or are dependent on each other, and one of them becomes dysfunctional, we have to know that it's going to have an effect on the other thing. So as we look at the pelvis, as we look at the sacrum, as we look at the hips, we have to tie all these things together, because they don't live in a bubble, and they don't live independently. They are all together. So I hope that helps you to see a little bit the role the sacrum plays, how those top two sacral segments can be so vitally important to the function of the pelvis, but then how you can relate in hip pathology, and maybe even take a closer look at the pubic symphysis. So let's try to look at the pelvis as a whole and see it as a whole functioning unit, not as simply one joint that needs to be adjusted.